We'll have, as usual, welcome everybody. And we'll start with having Reverend Ralph bless our food.
And as usual, whatever condition it currently is in, let us join in prayer. We thank you, Lord, for the gift of this beautiful day. We thank you for the rains that nourish the earth and for the sunlight that brings us warmth and for every good gift that you continue to shower upon us. We thank you for this fellowship of love that binds us to each other and to you and gathers us here today. Truly, as we are present with each other and in your presence, bless this food, the hands that have prepared it, and this time of sharing it with one another. For all these gifts, we give you thanks in Jesus' name. Amen.
Well, like in the movies, I'm going to begin with a preview of coming attractions. We've secured Katie Woods, an elder care lawyer. You'll read about it in an article in the newsletter this week or this month. She was here like about 10 years ago. Some of you may remember, but she's going to come, and it's going to be Wednesday. For those of you who are regular, it's not a Thursday. We were only able to get her on Wednesday, April 3rd, and she's going to talk about estate planning. Even if you have a plan in place, it never hurts to kind of rethink it. Maybe you're from out of state. You need to be sure you're Utah-friendly, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, noon to 1, April 3rd. So, I also would like to thank you all for coming. Thank Reverend Ralph for praying our food into consumption. Thank Chris for, well, you know what he does. And thank Daniel for being here today. I just want to show you something. This is his CV, curriculum vitae, or credentials. About three pages worth. So I said to myself, this could take a long time. And so I asked Daniel if he had anything a little shorter to tell me about himself. I first remember Deanna and Daniel meeting them on a Zoom fellowship meeting. They were echoing in their new house because they had no furniture. And since then, they've become very frequent and wonderful contributors to our congregation. So he wrote that we might say that he's had over 45 years of experience counseling individuals, couples, and families in crisis, as well as running groups on the alcohol, drug recovery, and eating disorders units of a large medical center in Los Angeles. Daniel is currently semi-retired, except for some Sunday mornings when he preaches, and practices life as a life coach with clients in the U.S. and foreign countries. Daniel, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Can you all hear me okay? Okay. I don't know about you, but when somebody says, would you like to hear the good news or the bad news first? I always like going to the bad news first because they end on a good note. Well, that's what we're going to do today. We're going to take a look at the aging process. By the way, if you're still here, you're aging right now as we speak. The alternative to that is live fast, die young, and have a good-looking corpse. I would highly not recommend that. Okay, I thought we would take a look at some T-shirts that I came across. Is it because there's some people in the way?
Oh. I should know about age.
Are you the oldest person here?
97.
You should be giving the lecture.
Yeah. Right back.
Okay. I came across these t-shirts, but I'll try to get out of your way. Whoops, wrong direction. And then this one, if you can't see it. Don't piss off old people. The older we get, the less life in prison is a deterrent. And then I came across this quote, "Mortality is the price we pay for entrance into this attraction we call life." If you Google the World Health Organization, you'll find this. Energy, stamina, strength, decline, hearing loss, cataracts and refractive errors, back and neck pain, osteoarthritis, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, diabetes, cancer, cardiac and circulatory disease, stroke, balance issues, depression, dementia, possible severe consequences to virus and bacterial infections, heightened sensitivity to stress. Any of you ever experienced any of these?
I was 2 for 2 until you got to the third line.
Okay. See if I can make sure I'm getting the right one here. Sanjay Gupta. His parents are getting older and he's getting older, so he's done a lot of research on the aging process. And what he found out was, it's fascinating to me, the researchers found that we don't age at a constant rate through our lives, but rather burst, with the biggest changes coming around ages 34, 60, 78 on average. I just turned 78 a couple of months ago, so if I deteriorate in front of you, you'll know why. It's been saying our 60s are go-go, 70s go, 80s slow go, and 90s no go. Except that doesn't apply to Josephine. These are some predictions into the future. 2015, 80% of older people will be living in low and middle income countries. The pace of population aging is much faster than in the past. In 2020, the number of people aged 60 years and older outnumbered children younger than 5 years. Between 2015 and 2050, the proportion of the world's population over 60 years will nearly double, from 12 to 22%. Connie Zeig is a psychotherapist, and I thought this was a good quote. In the context of age, most of us learn that being independent, quick, productive, and strong are highly valued and result in rewards of approval and status. On the other hand, we learn their opposite traits: dependent, slow, unproductive, and weak, are devalued and result in disapproval and shame. Naturally, we dread the loss of these socially acceptable traits as we age: slow down, do less, and need others more. We can learn to slow down, turn within with curiosity, and open what's calling to us without dismissing it and without being taken over by it. This is probably one of the most important quotes I've ever come across in my career. All of you know Sigmund Freud. Most of you probably know him as a psychotherapist, which he was, but he was really a neurologist. And how he turned to the realm of psychology is he had patients that were paralyzed, maybe from the waist down or an arm or whatever. He would take them to a hypnotist in France, and under hypnosis, they get out of the wheelchair and walk around. They'd use the arm. When hypnosis was over, they were paralyzed again. That's when he changed from what's going on in the body to what's going on in the mind. That outgrowth was psychology. His disciple at first and then went away from him was Carl Gustav Jung. His father was a minister, and he studied under Freud. Freud increasingly became very pessimistic as World War II was looming, and he basically died a bitter old man, believing that humans basically seek pleasure and avoid pain, and that's as good as it gets. His disciple, Carl Gustav Jung, said, "No, there's more." But he added this: "The first half of life is devoted to forming a healthy ego. The second half is going inward and letting go of it." What he meant by ego is, when we're young, we're building a career, reputation, marriage, children, all of that. What happens is we try, as we age, to re-engage that throughout our lives, and that leads to the second part. Thoroughly unprepared, we take the step into the afternoon of life. Worse still, we take this step with false presupposition that our truths and our ideals will serve us as hitherto. But we cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning. For what was great in the morning will be little at evening, and what in the morning was true at evening will become a lie. I've seen that so often in my practice. Somebody gets a middle-age crisis, which should be a middle-age reevaluation, and they try to do everything they did when they were younger, and they make a fool of themselves. Henry Miller wrote this. His title was "The Land of the Very Old." He says, "Unfortunately, I like the flawed, very old man I see in the mirror now, so I intend to pursue self-discovery until the very end because it is a source of my present well-being. Here is a paradox simply told. Even while I'm moving deeper into the very old age, recognizing and recording my own diminishing as time passes, my truth is that this last decade has been the happiest of my entire life. If that is not mind-blowing paradox, I don't know what is." So I'm trying to point out the possibilities as we all age and diminish. I came across this in 1976. M. Scott Peck, MD, psychiatrist who wrote a book, The Road Less Traveled. By the way, it's still on the most popular selling list. I try to read it once every year myself, and I always get something new out of it. He says, "You cannot live well if you cannot grieve well, for life is a series of losses until you lose life as you know it." Unfortunately, American culture does not permit grief and the expression of it. I had a friend that went to Europe, and he said, eating at a sidewalk cafe with some Europeans, "You know, you Americans are always smiling all the time." And he came back and he thought about that, and that's because our culture teaches us to express happiness, right? I mean, it's even written in the preamble of our Constitution, right? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of what?
Happiness.
Happiness. Other cultures in the world peace of mind is what they promote. Okay? So we get these cultural learnings. And as Peck says, it's really true. Life is a series of losses. And the trouble is, if you don't experience the loss and deal with it and know how to do that in a process, they build up. And one day, you wake up totally depressed and you can't figure out why you can't get out of bed. Everything looks bad. It's because the door that you've been putting that stuff in the closet, you've opened it up one too many things and it can come out. When I was concluding my practice in California, just after I had married Deanna and was going to move to Florida, I walked outside, looked at the door. I had a suite on the second floor, shared it with three other psychotherapists. And when I went home, I wrote this. So I was just about 65. The title is, Who is This Man? I don't recognize myself, stripped of the starched shirt, the name and title on the glass, the business card with a list of my qualifications, schedule jammed to the max, important because I'm needed. I do expanding well. I'm learning to contract and diminished, not without grief, anxiety, and confusion. Where will I get my importance now? Why is importance so important? Moving from a human doing to a human being. A slow but important process. God help me. One of the things that I want to talk about, I learned this when I was studying at chaplain's training at a medical school in Southern California. And the professor brought up that we're a multidimensional unity, that we're unified, but we've got these parts of ourself. And he mentioned that there's the body, the mind, and the soul. And if we don't pay attention to all of them, we get out of balance. And that's when we experience dis-ease. I love that word, dis-ease. But as research went on, there's one thing missing, and that's what I want to put in next. Relationships. There was a very interesting study that was done. It is the longest Harvard study, 85 years. They studied these guys that graduated, and they continued every 6 months to a year checking on them, health, how's your marriage, how's your career, all of that. What they found was the ones that were healthiest physically and mentally and spiritually were the ones that had good relationships during that whole time. By the way, I want to say, in relationships, we usually think of a relationship with someone else, but it's just as important the relationship we have with ourselves. I have clients, well, she treats her two rabbits amazingly well. If there's any kind of problem, they go to the vet and all of that, change the diet if there's an allergic reaction and all of that, but she doesn't do any physical exercise. She doesn't really do anything except come to me. But when our session's over, she doesn't continue. That's the problem. She doesn't have a good relationship with herself. Her husband loves her. She knows I love her, but she doesn't love herself yet. So one of the most important relationships we can have is with ourself, with our friends, with our partner if we have one, and especially with the divine, with God. So, in this study, 85-year study, the conclusion is contrary to what you might think, it's not career achievement, money, exercise, or a healthy diet. The most consistent finding we've learned through the 85 years of study is positive relationships keep us happier, healthier, and help us live longer, period. I want to talk about, have any of you ever taken part in a play? Okay. Then you've probably been given something to study before you had your first session. It's called a script, right? One of the things I've learned when I get a new client, I listen very carefully and I ask some questions because I want to find out which one of these scripts they live, because that's going to determine how successful our interaction is going to be. Okay, so let's take a look at these. Let me back up for a minute. A script tells who the characters are, the beginning, the middle, and the end of the play, how things turn out. Okay, let's take a look at winner script. By the way, I'll go with the loser script first. I don't get people in loser script anymore because I refuse to take court referral cases, because usually all they did was try to get me to let them know they could have unsupervised visits with their children again, or could go home because they were battering their wives and that kind of thing. And then they returned to their state. So they only came to me court referral case. People with loser scripts, they can be, I'm not talking about homeless people that like being homeless. Can you believe it? Some people like being homeless. They don't want no commitments of any sort, okay? But I'm not talking about them or people that are mentally ill. I'm talking about people that they go to prison and they come out and they're a walking crime wave within 6 months and they get back in. That's their script. I don't have them as clients. Let's take a look at the winner script. A winner script, they're not people that are perfect and don't make mistakes. Actually, they make more mistakes because they try more things. They're very creative. But they don't make the same mistake more than once. Okay? That's what makes a winner script. Let me tell you about a guy that I knew personally when I was Glendale Adventist Medical Center. His name was Dr. Paul Shearer. He was an oncologist. He walked sometimes with a cane. Sometimes he didn't have it and all of that. He had polio when he was a child. He wanted to go to medical school because he wanted to be a doctor. He felt that was God's calling him. That's what he wanted to do. Okay, we're talking about years ago. He went to the dean in a wheelchair, and the dean said, "Paul, I'm not going to admit you. Nobody's going to want to see a doctor in a wheelchair. I mean, come on. Besides that, how are you going to get up the stairs? How are you going to do your labs? How are you going to do all of this stuff? So I'm not going to admit you. Find some other kind of line of work." Paul was silent as he tells a story. He looked at the dean straight in the eye and he said, "You will hear from my lawyer next week. If I cannot come here, you will have the biggest lawsuit you've ever had." He says, "Okay, Paul, have it your way if that's what you're going to do." He not only made it to all the labs, he got some assistance from students around him. I mean, these were before wheelchair ramps and all of that were law. He graduated summa cum laude, an amazing physician. I used to ride motorcycles with him. He had a big Honda Goldwing weighing about 1,200 pounds. That's a winner script. You make mistakes, you come from behind, but you and God work it through to your advantage. Most of the clients I get are non-winner script. What is non-winner script like? See, non-winners are not losers, but they're not winners because they don't maximize their potential. And not only that, they often have the fear of success personality syndrome, as I call it. And so when they do something really good, they offset it with something really bad. So plus 3 minus 3 equals, if I remember my algebra right, 0. And that's how they live their lives. They never max it out. Mel Gibson, recovering alcoholic for over 14 years, and he started drinking again and just left his family and his kids, found a younger woman, got her pregnant, beat her up, got the, you know, another. That's a non-winner script. I mean, man is totally talented. Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, you can name them, men and women. They have the non-winner script. Next, I want to talk about, this builds on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but it takes it to better research. And there are 6 basic human needs. And the idea is, if you're going to be reasonably satisfied, fulfilled, and happy in this life, you need to have 4 of them. If you're going to be fulfilled, you get to have all 6 of them. Okay? So I wanted to present that to you today. So the first one is certainty. We need to have certainty. And that includes comfort, security, familiarity, and routine. But notice what the second one is. Variety. That's uncertainty. Surprise, variation, change. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, you need to get these give. You need to give these to yourself. You need to get them in your marriage. You need to get them from a friend. And you need to get them if you're working from your career. And you need to get it in your church as well. Okay? So I have clients that they're getting some of these at work, but in their marriage or in themselves they're not getting it. And I found I use this as a template that when I'm feeling uneasy, I sit down and think, which of these needs am I not getting met and from where? And then I seek to change it. And it usually works, changing it. Okay, so certainty, variety, surprise, variation, change. And third is significance. We need to be important. We need to have meaning and we need to have value. You know, one of the things growing up as a male in this culture, women do this far better. Guys usually joke at each other and put each other down and compete. We hardly say to each other, man, I missed you. I love you. I'm glad to see you again. You know, sounds really weird for men. Now, younger guys, they're easier with that, giving hugs to each other and all of that. But we need to know we're significant, and we need to believe we're significant to ourselves, that relationship with ourselves. The fourth is love and connection. We need to love and be loved, and we need to belong. The trouble is that many of my clients, who they belong to, are people that put them down or people on drugs, a lot of alcohol, a lot of out-of-control sexual activity and all of that. Then they feel bad about themselves, but they know they belong there. One of the things that they've researched about gangs is that need to belong. That's why they're a member of the gang. Okay? The fifth one is growth and development. We need to improve and max our potential. If we don't have something that we're learning and growing, we're going to deteriorate. And the last one is contribution. We give beyond the self. And the concentration then is on someone else. In my own journey, I'm a recovering perfectionist. I'm a recovering people helper. We call that a codependent in my lingo. And contribution was the one that was highest on my list. Taking care of myself was at the bottom. Through the help of psychotherapy and God, I was able to turn some of these things around to help myself. So One of the things they found with this research is that people tend to live two of them, and they revolve their life around two of these six. Okay? Stress. Stress seems to be the initiator of all kinds of things. And what the research shows in neuroscience research, the hypothalamus, the pituitary, the adrenal cortex, that's an axis that occurs, and once that goes, produces cortisol over a long period of time. And if it's a short burst, like giving this talk, okay, I got cortisol going through me right now. But this afternoon, I'm going to relax. I'm going to go for exercise, go to the gym, going to do all of that stuff, going to relax. You get back. But if people like high-stress jobs, police department, emergency room doctors, all of that kind of stuff, especially around full moon, I don't know why full moon, but it always seems to work that way. The cortisol, not only over a period of time, you lose memory, cognition, function, and the size of your brain literally shrinks. Okay? So it builds on itself. You don't think very well. Get control of your stress before it takes control of you. I love this. When you had a rough day, but you're trying to stay positive, it's great. I'm great. Everything's great. But not really. I remember someone said, you know, I get tired of people saying cheer up when everything's going their way. Soul care. We're a multidimensional unity. And I came across these in doing the research for this talk. Wisdom belongs to the aged and understanding to the old. And I will still be carrying you when you are old. Your hair will turn gray, and I will still carry you. I made you, and I will carry you to safety. Even to your old age and gray hairs, I am he. I am he who will sustain you. I have made you and I will carry you. I will sustain you and I will rescue you. And then Romans 8, God causes all things to work together for good to them that love God and are called according to his purpose. One of the things I've found is that our beliefs are really important, and not only our spiritual beliefs, but going to our life script, what we believe. I want to share this with you. This is 1957 UCLA. Psychologist Bruno Kopfler published an article in a peer-reviewed journal telling the story of a man he referred to as Mr. Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, who had advanced lymphoma. The man had huge tumors, some as big as an orange, in his neck, groin, and armpits, and his cancer was not responding at all to conventional treatments. He lay in his bed for weeks, febrile, gasping for air, completely bedridden. His doctor, Philip West, had given up hope, although Wright himself had not. When Wright found out that the hospital where he was being treated in Long Beach, California, just happened to be one of the 10 hospitals and research centers in the country that were evaluating an experimental drug extracted from horse blood called cribiazin. He got excited. Belief. Wright unrelentingly badgered Dr. West for days until the physician agreed to give him some of this new remedy. Even though Wright couldn't officially be part of the trial, which required patients to have at least a 3-month life expectancy. Wright received his injection of curbiocin on Friday, and by Monday he was walking around, laughing, joking with the nurses, acting pretty much like a new man. Dr. West reported that the tumors had melted like snowballs. Within 3 days, the tumors were half their original size. In 10 more days, they were gone, and Wright was sent home. He had been cured. It seemed like a miracle. But 2 months later, the media reported that the 10 trials showed that curbiocin turned out to be a dud. Once Wright read the news, became fully conscious of the results, and embraced the thought that the drug was useless, he relapsed immediately, and his tumors returned. Dr. West suspected that Wright's initial positive response was due to the placebo effect, and knowing that his patient was terminal, he figured he had little to lose, and Wright had everything to gain by testing out this theory. So the doctor told Wright not to believe the newspaper reports and that he had suffered a relapse because the curbiocin they had given Wright was found to be a bad batch. What Dr. West called a new super refined double strength version of the drug was on the way to the hospital, and Wright could have it as soon as it arrived. In anticipation of being cured, Wright was elated, and a few days later, he received the injection. But this time, the syringe Dr. West used contained no drug. Experimental or not, the syringe was filled only with distilled water. Again, Wright's tumors magically vanished. He happily returned home and did well for another 2 months, free of tumors in his body. But then the American Medical Association made the announcement that curbiocin was indeed worthless. The medical establishment had been duped. The miracle drug turned out to be a hoax, nothing more than mineral oil containing a simple amino acid. The manufacturers were eventually indicted. Upon hearing the news, Wright relapsed a final time. No longer believing in the positivity of health, he returned to the hospital hopeless. 2 days later, he died. Someone once asked me, what would you say on your dying day? Daniel, what's the most important thing that you learned while you were alive? I thought of that for a while, and I said, belief is everything. You know, Scripture says, as a man thinks in his heart, so shall it be. Jesus said, as your faith, so shall it be unto you. So it's really important that we have some positivity. And Scripture lets us know that God is with us no matter where we are or what happens. I love this. From Pablo Picasso and Jesus the Christ. Picasso first. It took me 4 years to paint like Raphael, but a lifetime to paint like a child. And then Jesus. Unless you become as little children, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. We should be growing younger all the time. You know, one of the things about being the age I am, I could care less about if I have to return something to the waitress, which I would never do. I would just eat bad food because I didn't want to put anybody out. It was okay if I was put out, but I didn't want to put anybody else out. Carolyn Miss is a what's been called a medical intuitive. The best I can describe it is when I was getting massage therapy when I was in California, Northern California. Her name was Gloria Martisich, and she had an MA in sports physiology. So she had a lot of athletes coming to her for a massage and whatever. And I'd be laying on the table, and before she would ever touch me, she would take both her hands, start with my head over this much of my body without touching me, and go down one side and come around the other side. She took her time, and then she'd say, Daniel, have you been going through a lot of grief this week? Or who are you angry at? It was amazing, okay? That kind of person. I don't know how they do it. They just do it. Carolyn Mace is a medical intuitive. She says, free yourself from the burden of wanting things, of needing to accomplish anything, of being driven by the desire to please others. Finally, close your eyes and listen to the wild voice of your soul and let go. As you prepare to leave this life and your thoughts inevitably turn to what you could have done, may you not wish that you had been more courageous. There's a book of prayers that she did. She says, I must say, Lord, one thing about aging that has surprised me, and it really has, is that I feel more outrageously loving the older I get. Between you and me, I'm curious about that. I've noticed that the older I've gotten, the less I want anything. What I do want now is to know more about life, to understand more about people, and to do more for others. And here's the thing about love. Whatever love is, I find it so easy to see the good in people without having to hardly search for it anymore. One of the things that we can do that research shows about the stress is meditation and mindfulness. Mindfulness is the concept, well, let me back up. We usually, I don't know about you, but I tend to be always in the future. I'm sitting here, maybe eating my lunch, and I'm thinking what I'm going to do 2 hours from now. Any of you have that issue going on? Mindfulness is be here now, take a deep breath, feel the food in your mouth. Taste it. One of the reasons why in the eating disorder unit, people that were morbidly obese, is they would eat in front of the television and they never tasted their food. Okay? If you're holding hands with your spouse, feel their hand. Don't be somewhere else. Okay? So the concept of mindfulness, be here, be now. It's interesting in Hebrew, in ancient Hebrew, there's only present tense. There's not past. God is here always, now. Moses said, who shall I, you're sending me back to Egypt. Okay. They got a bunch of gods. What's your name? I am. Present tense, verb to be, here, now. So mindfulness is learning to be present. You live better. You take in. There's more to be thankful for that. And the other is meditation. The ability to just let go and quit trying to think your way into everything. To just be. And that's where God can really come in with his spirit to help us and say, Daniel, you need to be doing this more. Or you need to let go of that. Or have you thought about this? But not when I'm busy helping everybody because I'm on top of it all, you know, listening, watching, all of that. But when I'm non-doing, see, that's not the same as doing nothing. Non-doing, that's when God's Spirit can speak to me. Be still. Can you complete the rest of that? And know that I am God. Okay, let me see. I think I covered everything. Yeah, I did. So, do you have any questions? Yes. Sure. There's a great book for anybody to read. I think it's worth whether you're grieving the present or not. It's called The Wild Edge of Sorrow, and I can't think of the psychologist's name right now, but it's called The Wild Edge of Sorrow. And the first third of the book, he sets out how important it is. By the way, in Isaiah, it says that the Messiah was going to be a man of what?
Sorrow.
And that goes back to what Scott Peck said. If you can't grieve well, you can't live well, because life's a series. By the way, Deanna and I were watching American Pickers. I don't know if you folks have ever heard of American Pickers. But there's this guy. Everything in his house is like the 1950s because he refuses change. He fears change. And he doesn't want to grieve that what was will never be again. But that's the only, as I've said to my clients, God never can fill an already full hand. It's got to be empty. And we don't like empty hands. We don't like not knowing what our future is going to be. So that helped answer the question. That book is a great book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow. Any other questions? Yes. You know, thank you for bringing that up, Ralph. You know, studying theology, talk about the fall and the depravity of man, total depravity, as it's called. You know, we're the children of God, and there's some real goodness in us. Why do we always focus on the negative, you know, and then we look for it, all of that. But there's original goodness, and we forget. This original goodness is original depravity. So thank you for bringing that up. Any other questions? Yes.
We have knowledge of a couple, and the husband's just gotten a terminal diagnosis. It's not necessarily aging, but obviously they probably age too much.
Yeah. That's tricky because all of us don't like change. That's a universal human thing. We like holding on to things and keeping them forever the same. And so, depending on the person, now, are you asking about him or the family? Okay. Well, one of the things in hospital chaplaincy is to find out, do they want help? Okay. See, a lot of times we want to rush in with a solution. And I had to be very careful of that as a young, budding psychotherapist. I got a lot of cures. I got this big bag of things I can help you with, and they're not ready to be helped. I've had some clients that they've said to me, Daniel, when am I going to change this crazy behavior of mine? And I said, when you've hit bottom and you've suffered enough. Oh, I'm suffering. And I said, but you haven't suffered enough yet. You know, in AA, the idea is hit bottom, but sometimes you don't come back. Sometimes you die when you hit bottom. You know, I've seen some people, they lost their job, they lost their spouse, their kids don't want anything to do with them, they lost their driver's license because of several DUIs, and they still don't want to admit they're alcoholics. So therefore, they can't get treatment. So, yeah, be sensitive, because when we care for people, we want to make it better, don't we? Right? What we need to do many times is enter where they are. That just having somebody there with us, maybe even in the pit. Remember in the book of Job, his friends came and everything was great as long as they kept their big mouth shut. You know? But then they want to make it better. You must have sinned. You must have done this. Repent. You'll be restored. And Job said, I haven't done anything. I don't know why. Okay? So the best thing when you see somebody else and you see your heart goes out, keep in mind that that's you. Okay? You can simply say, I'm really sorry you're going through this. Is there anything that I can do for you? They'll usually tell you if they're ready for something. And that's the best I can say to that. I hope that makes some sense. Yeah, and the worst thing is to grieve alone. And I don't know about you guys, but I was raised as an American male, and you don't cry on the playground and you get beat up more and get called names, right? Right? So men, hold it all in. Remember, I got the referral from a neurologist. This guy came to me. He was in World War II at the time. He was in World War II. He lost his sister, his brother, and his wife. And he came to me and he says, yeah, the doctor said I should be here, but I'm doing just fine. And I said, let me see, this and this and this and this. Are you sure you're doing okay? And just one little tear on the side trickled down his face. Be strong. I'm rough and tough and hard to bluff. That's why we die about 10 to 15 years sooner than women. Because women can talk about their feelings. You know? They can talk about, they feel deficient in certain areas and they can get some help and support and all of that. Well, we men, we just tough it out. And I think we suffer greatly for that. Yeah.
Is that just because the female body is better, is constructed better?
Okay.
Or is it because of the psychological?
Okay. Interesting point. I hate to say this because a lot of women have used this on their husbands later. We all start out to be females. But to become male, we actually go through brain damage, okay? Literally in the process of becoming male in the womb. And that's the reason why girls tend to be farther ahead at the same age than the boys, because their brains are trying to catch up, okay? So there are some deficiencies that just, and also there's a difference between male brain and female brains. Female brains, God wired to be relational, okay? Males were designed to be aggressive and protective. I don't know, do you know of any world wars that started by women? Okay? That's because, and that's because we men are wired with...
We'll get there.
We men are wired with testosterone and the kind of brain we have. That's why we do adventure. We take risks and all of that kind of stuff. We're protectors. But if it gets out of control, just like with women, if it gets out of control and there's so much caring for their girlfriends or their children or whatever, and they don't take care of themselves, see how it can go bad for them as well. So there's differences between men and women. It's amazing that it's been said if it wasn't for sexual attraction and needing to make new species, we probably never get together. And you probably have noticed, you go to a restaurant and husbands and wives will be there and they'll be on their thing, staring out the window. They don't talk to each other anymore. Okay, but when guys get with guys, they got a lot, or women get with women. So it takes work to take care of ourselves, maintain good relationships, and practice all these things. Okay, it's not easy. But if you don't know about these things, and that's what I believe my work is, helping. I've got a lot of young men and women in my practice in their 20s and 30s right now, and some in their 70s. But they've never heard any of this stuff. And they're getting a chance to practice. And even some of this guy is in his 70s practicing, and he's changing his life for the better. It's so cool. It's invigorating for me to see people do that. Oh, I forgot to tell you this one story. I was 29 at the time, just starting out in my practice. I was a co-leader of a group, and the mother came to my supervisor and said, "My son, I'd like to get him to come to see somebody. He attempted suicide a couple of months ago. He's really depressed, but I think he needs somebody younger. What about Daniel?" So my supervisor came and said, "Okay, so I got a suicidal case starting out. All right." So he came, and I noticed the way he dressed. Well, first of all, he was super intelligent. But the car he drove in, he called it his faith mobile. He never knew when he turned the key whether it was going to start. He lived in a bad part of Burbank, California. And this is what he did for a living. He drove a van for senior citizens to go to different museums and different places. And this guy was about smarter than anybody here in the room, including me. Just super intelligent, but he had the non-winner script. Now, in his family, by the way, this is a whole other lecture, but family systems theory, his brother was a superstar, and he was always the one that was behind. And he took that role even in society. As we worked together, he changed the lousy flea-bitten apartment he was in. He got a better used car. He moved to a different part of town. And he said, "I'm really bored with doing what I'm doing." And I go, "Well, of course, driving around senior citizens." And I said, "What would you like to do?" He goes, "Well, I like this thing of psychology. Maybe I'll become a therapist someday." I said, "Okay, well, you got the brain for it. I don't know if you have the heart for it yet, but you'll find that out." So he went to the university and did a 4-year degree in 2. After he graduated, he came into a session and he says, "I don't want to do what you do. I don't want to sit with people and listen to them moan and groan and whatever." I'd given him assignments and he always would come back with some creative written thing. Just blow me away. I mean, just super intelligent guy. And I said, "Why don't you do what you do naturally? Why don't you become a writer?" He said, "Well, what am I going to do? Just put a sign up, I'm a writer?" And I said, "No, you don't do that. But think of something of what you could do. What in writing? You know, you could write. There are these, they need instructions for things. You could write and put some humor in it, and you'd be doing a job writing." He did that. Of course, he wound up becoming a manager and all of that. And he came in one day and he said, "It's too boring. It's not creative enough." And I go, "I knew that was going to be sooner or later. It's beneath you, all of that. But now you have a network of writers. Now you can start asking some people, you know, I'd like something a little more creative," and so forth and so on and whatever. He did that. He's a writer for Steven Spielberg now. From a non-winner script to a winner script. That's why I'm still in the saddle, and that's why I enjoy doing what I do, those kind of stories. Anything else? Anybody else have any questions? Yeah, Paul.
So let me back into this. I recently ran across a statement that despair is the shadow of hope. One could say death is the shadow of life, or a choir singing out of tune is a shadow of a choir that's really singing in tune. I don't know if that's ambiguity, that is, how do we deal with the duality of that?
Yeah, and that's called, it's not contradiction, it's paradox. The two things are simultaneously true but different at the same time. A rainbow is a paradox. It has to be raining and it has to be sunny at the same time or you don't have a rainbow. Okay? So that's, I'm glad you brought that point out. That finally in despair when we give up, that's when we have an empty hand that God could come in. An example, I remember this story. You know the program, the old program, Touched by an Angel? You remember that program? Okay. This woman, she just got news that it was possible terminal cancer. And her husband left her. She's all alone. She's in unhealth, and she doesn't know where she's going to get a job in the future. So she goes to this Mexican restaurant. She takes table by herself. She's looking at the menu, and in comes a homeless-looking woman, sits across the way and sits down. And I can't remember the name of this woman, but she's looking at their menu, and she sees this homeless lady. And she says to the waitress, when the waitress comes over, tell that lady she can have anything she wants on the menu, I'll pay for it. Okay. So the waitress goes over and says that, and the woman looks at her and doesn't even smile, just looks at her and looks back at the menu. Then she gets up and says to the woman, would you like to come and join me? I'm alone here. Would you like to come and join me and as we can eat? Said, okay. So she came, brought the menu over. Okay, here's this woman not knowing the future, anything is going to happen. And this woman said, the homeless woman, I'm here today because you're going to be interviewed in the next week, and there's this job opening that's going to come. You're going to do a good job, and I'm here just to let you know that. She got up and walked out of the restaurant. Was it an angel? Was it somebody inspired? I have no idea. But notice the correlation. Desperation leads to hope, because there's nothing. Now I can be still, and who knows what God will show up with at the time. So thank you for bringing that up, Paul. That's an important point. Any other questions? I don't want to keep you folks too long. Anything else? I'm sorry? Yeah. Yes, that's right. And that's one of the reasons why Europeans aren't so happy, because they've experienced a lot of war, a lot of catastrophe for hundreds of years. We're a young country, right? We're still new kids on the block, so to speak. But yeah, Europeans, they can tell you of a lot of stuff that they've gone through. Well, thank you very much for being such a great audience. I really appreciate it.